could have gotten a lot less than I have gotten and been like thrilled. I mean, again, you have to remember, like, it's like I'm a second child. I'm from the Midwest. Like, my expectations were not that high. Yeah.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the senior editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing here at the University of Iowa. And listeners, spring has sprung here in Iowa City. The weather has turned, the birds have resumed their fluttering around our Craftsman four square porches, and the days are expanding, offering more light, more time to spend doing the thing all of us truly want to be doing, reading. One author I look forward to reading every time new work is released is the singular and unmatched Curtis Sittenfeld, who, if you can believe it, is here with us today in this very studio, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Curtis Sittenfeld is the best-selling author of seven novels, including Prep, The Man of My Dreams, American Wife, Sisterland, Eligible, Rodham, and Romantic Comedy, which was picked for Reese Witherspoon's book club. Her first story collection, You Think It, I'll Say It, was published in 2018, and Show Don't Tell, her newest collection, was just released in February. Sittenfeld's books have been selected by the New York Times, Time, Entertainment Weekly, and People for their 10 best books of the year list, optioned for television and film, and translated into 30 languages. Her short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Esquire, and in Best American Short Stories Anthology, which she was the 2020 guest editor of. Her nonfiction has appeared in The New York Times, Time, Vanity Fair, and The Atlantic, Slate, and on This American Life, and she is a graduate of Stanford University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Writing is a hard magic trick to pull off. As a writer, you have to take lines and curves, form them into letters, form those letters into words and phrases, make those phrases sentences, combine those sentences into paragraphs that build into not only pages but, and here's the tricky bit, also into reservoirs of emotional connectivity that a reader will want to dive into. It's on the writer then to not only dazzle the reader with language, but also to make sure the language presented doesn't reveal the sleight of hand. In other words, the magic of good writing is that it both engages and surprises, confounds and astounds, and as far as I'm concerned, there's no one better at this exact ability than Curtis Sittenfeld. When reading Curtis's work, whether her all-consuming novels or her exquisite short stories, I am moved through decades and postal codes, moved through ages and phases of life, and I am moved, if I can be honest, to a level of emotional reckoning that after reading, it often takes me literal days to step back and understand what I just witnessed. And all of that is based solely on Sittenfeld's incantation, her language spells that never fail to stun and stupefy me. Whether an imagined, what-if, alternative, personal, and historical narrative about our almost first Madam President, to the achingly real day-long wait for second-year funding at a prestigious MFA writing program, Sittenfeld's magic isn't in simple stirring of the plot, but rather in the detailed ingredients that make her characters burst to life. Sex and expected gender roles, politics and family dynamics, Midwestern living and deep human connection drive Sittenfeld's work, many times all at once. And in its collective enchantment, the writing seems to hold back from saying the thing many of us as readers expect to hear after reading it. Ta-da! The magic of this writer is a gift to any reader. And we are thrilled to have the chance to talk with this magician today in the studio with a hefty bravo. Please join me in welcoming to Sad Me of the Past, the one and only Curtis Sittenfeld.
Yay! Yes. That was extraordinarily generous. Thank you very much.
It's just about right. Yeah.
I mean, Curtis, I'll tell you, when we dreamed up this podcast, in all seriousness, and we talked about sort of dream guests. You were a dream guest.
Oh, yeah. No pressure.
But you're a writer.
You don't even have to speak. You can just exude your Curtis Sittenfeld nest.
Oh my God. I have to tell you, I whenever I have an introduction, like at a book event, I'm always like, oh, I wish I were her. Like me meaning the description of myself. Yeah. Like I'm And including that was truly exceptionally like lovely. Yeah, like I do not feel like that the other person. Thing.
Well, we were describing your Audi.
I know my family is obsessed with Severance, and one of my kids even made this for each of us, like for each family member, including the dog, and it's like your Audi does this, and literally this kind of. The person that I really am is like not the person in that introduction, but it was like your Audi likes to eat meat with the bone in. your Audi, and actually she did say like my kids who are teenagers like know my job, of course. There it was like your Audi has been she put derogatorily described as a book talk sensation, and then she's like, "Your Audi once ate a carrot in the shower," which did happen. I was pressed for time.
Yeah, I mean, when you don't
have
time,
they know the real you.
When I first had my baby, time felt like unreal.
Yeah.
And so I would eat Jimmy John sandwiches in the back.
Of course.
Yeah, where apparently you were also reading.
I was also reading. Eligible. Yeah, I dropped one of your books in the bath. I'm sorry, but not at the same time as the Jimmy John's.
That's a compliment. I mean, but really the question is, why don't we all eat Jimmy John's in the bath, even when we're not present? It's like,
because you can just clean up right afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By washing it down the drain?
Yeah.
Well, you need to get one of those. Need to get one of those like filters that you have for a sink.
I'm really glad we got to this part of the conversation early.
Yeah, our listeners are like, Curtis, when are we going to hear from Curtis?
Curtis, you are my favorite living author.
Oh,
true.
No offense to all the other authors. I realized that after I realized that you're the only writer where I'm waiting actively for the next book.
And she's read everything.
And I've finished every book. And this is big because
she barely reads.
I barely read. No, I'm an intellectual, but I also am very addicted to TikTok. And I've finished every book you've written. And so I have like just, I don't know, just so many. I have so many notes. I think it's punk rock that you based a book in Cincinnati. Like, that's hardcore.
Yeah.
I respect it. I'm so sick of books based in New York and LA. I cannot believe that you made me like almost fall in love with George W. Bush via Charlie. I actually had the relationship that you describe in Man of My Dreams. I'd never seen it written.
Mm.
A very weird, complex, like friendship romance.
Mm.
The Sam Madrid Fault is very popular now, and you were ahead of it by years.
Wait, is it popular now?
On TikTok, people are
See, I'm not on TikTok.
That's probably a good thing. Yeah.
People are talking about it.
Really? Like they think it's gonna
go.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I knew about that.
Based on what I read writing that book, I don't think that, but I don't have the latest from TikTok.
Well, and TikTok's not, you know,
reputable as a source of factual information.
Seismologically, right.
Factual. Reliable. Yeah, I don't know if the seismologists are talking about it. I think it's more, preppers.
Well, I think one thing I think we would love to do is, you know, you've brought something in to read from your youth. We don't know exactly when it's from yet, but maybe you could sort of just take us back and just sort of for context, tell us a little bit about when you started writing. You know, how old were you? How did your writing and reading sort of come to develop? When did it all start for you?
So I grew up in Cincinnati. Cool. I was born in 1975. So as we're having this conversation, I'm 49. I definitely, like, I loved to read and I loved to write from like the time I learned how. So, which I'm not even completely sure, you know, like, was I six? Was I five? Was I seven? But somewhere around there. And I think I just sort of inhaled books. And I also, so my mother actually ultimately was a middle school librarian, but it's not, and my parents did read aloud. I'm one of four siblings. They did read aloud to us Although, weirdly, I think we were almost more a magazine family than a book family. We subscribed to tons of magazines.
Awesome.
And I read – well, okay, so this is – oh, I feel like this is really getting down to – but I'll preface it and say, like I read, like, you know, from a very young – like, probably from the age of, like, 7 or 8 or whatever, like, Reader's Digest.
I love
or
Reader
like,
Digest.
Yeah, yeah, like you know, Humor in Uniform.
Yes, whatever, like, I remember that.
Drama in real life.
Yeah, tons of – and yeah. I would also – occasionally someone would give my mother a subscription to a women's magazine that she wouldn't read, and I would read like "Can This Marriage Be Saved" and "Good Housekeeping." But yeah. This is the really formative. I think this if you were to give like one sentence explanation, my parents had a subscription to Town and Country. Do you know Town and Country?
Yeah.
And I used to sit on the toilet reading Town and Country, and I feel like I grew up to be exactly the adult who like sat on the toilet reading Town and Country at like the age of 8 or what?
Wow.
All my interest.
This is like making
class.
So much sense. This is
I
making
know,
so
right.
much sense.
Well, and then I wrote for magazines in my 20s. Like my sort of first job out of college essentially was, you know, at a business magazine in Boston. And then during and after the workshop, I would freelance, including for Teen People, that sort of which
yes.
doesn't exist, but the junior version of People magazine. And I absolutely think that reading tons of magazines and writing for magazines influenced my fiction in a few different ways.
What are the ways, just out of curiosity?
So I would say probably the two or three main ways are, one, like trying to write clearly above all and like sort of accessibly and you know, kind of maybe doing weird things with like plot or character, but making the language really accessible.
Yeah.
Or like the scene is supposed to be clear. So that's one. I think, you know, like maybe not getting really emotional about things like deadlines and just feeling like you just kind of write it, like you just kind of crank it out at some point. And I think also doing fact-checking, like doing research for fiction and knowing like you can interview people for fiction and not only are they often like cooperative or willing, but a lot of times they're kind of tickled to be asked questions, yeah. even for fiction.
They love it.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
To be like an expert.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
that someone's interested
in
their experience.
Yeah.
When you're talking about loving to read and write from an early age, were your parents, with the magazines and everything else in your house, were they encouraging of your writing at an early age? Do you remember like writing a poem or a short story or getting some kind of sort of encouragement from them?
It's funny. So I am one of four siblings, and I'm the second. And I would say I was raised in sort of a stereotypically like 70s, 80s, slightly negligent way where I don't think they were like cultivating my interest. I mean, again, we did sometimes read aloud as a family, which my dad had a friend growing up and their family read aloud. And I think he was like, oh, that's so kind of like almost like what a beautiful movie version of being a family that is. And they kind of wanted to replicate that. And my dad himself definitely like loved reading magazines. And my mom read more like biographies or, you know, gardening books or something. And she now, like, she's retired. My dad passed away in 2021. And I actually send my mom books very often. Like, I'll read a book, I'll read a review, and I'll think, like, I don't know if I'll read. I mean, I would potentially read that if I had all the time in the world. Since I don't, I won't. But also, and she'll read it. Like, it would be like Ina Garten's memoir, or there's a memoir by someone named Curtis Chin that's called something, which, of course, you know, Curtis to Curtis, who doesn't love it?
Mm-hmm.
But it's called something like Everything I Know About Life I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant About Growing Up in Detroit. And, mm-hmm. and like, she really, there's just something where I can, like, it, like, sets off my, like, like Betsy Sittenfeld antennae or something. And so it's like she, and it's an interesting thing to see because, again, you know, she had four children. She worked full time at a school. So she didn't have much time to read. And now that she does have time, she spends a ton of time reading. Or like, again, if I send her a book, she might easily read it in like 2 days or something. So yeah, wait. And of course, I've kind of forgotten the question.
Well, no, but so they were encouraging.
So my writing was actually kind of private hobby. And I wouldn't say, like, if I wrote something, I wouldn't necessarily, there was probably a very low chance I would show it to anyone in my family. I think in school, I started to have more of a public identity, like, as a writer, where, I mean, I even remember in, like, third grade, we did something called the Daily Edit, where the teachers would write a sentence on the board that had mistakes, and we would all copy it and correct the mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I think the peak of my life was, like, one time I was the only person who could, and I think it might have been, like, a me-I thing. So it's, like, I think I was, it was understood that I was, like, good at English. And then I remember in fourth grade, I remember standing up in front of the class and reading something that I had written. But again, there was this sort of purity to it, which ended pretty early because I started being published at such a young age in high school. But I definitely endlessly wrote because I wanted to write, not for any other reason. Yeah. And I endlessly read because I wanted to read, not for any other reason. And I'm sorry to say, neither of those things has been true for like 30 years.
So, but when did you first understand the concept that like being a writer was a thing, like a thing you could do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I knew we had a family friend who had gone to the workshop for poetry, who was probably 15 years older than I was. So I think from the time I was like 15-ish, maybe younger, but I knew that. And then, and actually, when I graduated from college, my parents, as a present, as a sort of graduation present, bought his, I mean, it was probably like an 8-year-old Ford Taurus station wagon, and that became my car. And I think that I felt like it had good energy because he was a poet and had gone to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. So even though it was this like total, you know, middle-aged mom car, and I was like 22, and I was like, clearly this is the right car for me.
Well, that's how it works, is that a poet assigns the title of a car over to you, and you become a writer.
Yeah, that's what I never got a car. That's what
I know.
Well, I got like 3 or 4 wasted them.
So did that sort of continue like into junior high and high school? Like, is that, did your sort of writer self begin to sort of emerge and get like, were you continuing to write then, and were you writing in a more
So I never ever stopped writing, and you know, I have wondered at times, like, because I was extraordinarily lucky to kind of get affirmation from an early age. And I've wondered, you know, would I have kept, and I know most writers, I think, have, like, it's the norm to have done that, not to have not done that. Would I, and I definitely think I would have always kept writing. Like, maybe it would have just occupied a different space in my life. But so again, I went to boarding school from Cincinnati. I was the only one of my siblings who did. It was a little, there's 6 explanations of why I went to boarding school, but none of them were that I was like gifted or anything like that. Like, my siblings were probably all academically, I mean, I was a good student, but I wasn't a superstar, and probably all my siblings were stronger academically than I was. And I actually started to struggle with a bunch of subjects at boarding school, including, like, my boarding school is called Groton. It's in Massachusetts. I struggled with, like, math especially, but also, like, French and, you know, biology. And I think during that time, I was kind of like, oh, if I'm getting, you know, if I always get an A in English, like I can't afford to hide my light under a bushel. Like, there's one thing I'm good at. Like, I'm not good at sports, which I had to play. I'm not good at, it was almost like history. I was competent, but like, I wasn't really very good at almost any other subject. I wasn't particularly socially charming. So it was like, and, but I also was very interested. Like, I read in high school, the Paris Review and like Newsweek and every women's magazine I could get my hands on. But I also, like, you know, joined the staff of the literary magazine in high school. And so it became more and more of my identity.
So when you were at boarding school, so you sort of writing through elementary school and junior high school, winning the edit, daily edit prize every day.
Yeah.
By the time you get to this experience at boarding school and being on the Lit Mag, were you finding a community of other people that, I mean, to even think at high school that you were reading the Paris Review, in addition to things like Newsweek or whatnot, were you coming to that all that stuff on your own? Was there a group of others that you felt sort of supported this idea? Did you have a teacher that sort of supported it? Or, because we're just a few years in age apart, and like, so it'd be like sort of before the internet was so accessible to everything. So you couldn't just go somewhere and get it all.
Yeah.
How were you kind of making these connections? Did you have a group or a teacher that was sort of connecting you to this world?
I think so. I did have an English teacher and advisor at Groton, and she did one time say to me, go buy the best American short stories and go buy the O. Henry Prize stories. And it was, I think it was maybe the summer between my junior and senior years in high school. I mean, it's funny because I can still remember the like room in the library I would go into to read the Paris Review. And I would not be surprised if I was the only student who read it at my 300 plus person boarding school. So I think I did, or I would read poets and writers. And I mean, again, as like a 16-year-old, which the hilarious thing, I know. The hilarious thing about if I pick up a copy of Poets and Writers now, it gives me like retroactive anxiety. Like I'm almost like, what if I don't find an agent?
Right.
Go back.
So just on that, were you feeling already at that age a kind of like pressure about writing? Like, were you feeling, was there any anxiety associated with it in that period, or were you still very comfortable doing it and sort of at ease with this whole sort of professionalized world ahead? Did you want to get into it? What did it make you nervous? Or some combination?
So I don't think that I understood. Like I was kind of like endlessly curious about how it worked. And I didn't understand. I think I didn't quite understand the various distinctions. Like I didn't really expect to be a full-time novelist, which I don't think anybody who would expect that would be unrealistic. But I didn't. So I don't think I necessarily, like, I think if you had said, what do you want your profession to be? I actually would have said social worker, which I had all these kind of preoccupations with being like a good person or wanting to be like useful to society. And I think when I look back, I think like, oh, I wanted to want to be a social worker, but I didn't want to be I wasn't like pursuing internships in social work, whereas I was, again, like from a very young age, like reading poets and writers. And I was like entering contests. So I won 17 Magazine's fiction contest the summer before my senior year. Wow.
17 Magazine, the coolest magazine around?
Actually, Sassy was then the coolest magazine, but
Sassy was way beyond me.
17 was sort of older and had this established, like, so the person, I think like Sylvia Plath and maybe like Laurie Moore and Joyce Carol, all of them had definitely written fiction for 17. Some of them had, I think, won the contest. And actually, the sort of funny thing that didn't have as much meaning then, but Jennifer Egan was the person who was judge.
No way.
In 1992. Wow. She was the judge. I submitted 8 stories, as one does. and she, so again, I just had
God.
Like, it was like I had this one interest and she picked one. And I think that she was almost like it could have been one of any of these 3 or something. And like, we've kind of kept in touch over the years.
Does she remember that you were the one?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Because then I went to hear her at a reading, like, you know, give a reading in when I was in college. And I admire her a lot. Like, I just think she's a really smart person who kind of, like, so I feel like I was pretty influenced. This is now going back to maybe like 2006, by which point Prep had come out. But I heard her, she did an event in Philadelphia, and I lived there then. And she said, this might be paraphrasing, but she said, I would never want to write a book that I knew from the outset I was capable of pulling off. And I found that very inspiring.
Yeah.
My mom didn't let me read 17 magazine until I was 17.
Oh, wow. That's so funny because I think I literally got my hands on a copy in like fourth grade when I would have been nine.
Yes.
And I do feel like, I mean, maybe this is how people now feel about the internet. Like, I was like, it was this portal to just like so much juiciness. Like,
oh, yeah.
It blew my mind.
Yeah. Just get in there on the toilet, shut the door, and like.
Town and country, that's, 17.
That's like the original internet. It's your own bathroom with a bunch of magazines.
One toilet and seven magazines.
Right, right, right.
So you said that there's a space that you went in your school to read the Paris Review. You remember that room. Do you remember where you were writing? Like, was there a specific spot?
Oh, yeah. Well, so sometimes I would write, like in high school, sitting on my bed, you know, kind of with like bad posture, like leaning, sort of sitting sideways on the bed with my back against the wall, like in a notebook. And then also my roommate had a desktop computer and I did not. And I would endlessly write. She was very generous where it was sort of like, I could treat it like mine as long as she wasn't using it. So I would endlessly write on that. But I remember reading, I feel like this is a sort of famous writerly tidbit that when Jane Austen would write, there was like a creak and she'd like creak in the floor. And so she'd like flip over her notebook or whatever. And I was very much like again, it was this thing where writing was kind of private to me until I had this understanding of like I can't be private about the one thing that I, you know, am competent at. But it is funny that I mean there's such a weird mix of like humility and like grandiosity and mm-hmm. and from a young age being like, oh, I totally identify with Jane Austen.
There's a story of Flannery O'Connor when she was here that she wrote in like just a barren room in the apartment with a light bulb hanging from the ceiling. And I just think it's so dramatic.
Yeah. It's, well, you almost wonder if you're like doing that for your biographers
right.
to later discuss. Yeah.
Right. Somebody notice.
Yeah. Like, do you know, like supposedly in Silicon Valley, like some people will like deliberately do some of their startup stuff in a garage.
Mm-hmm. So they can say later.
Yeah. Classic.
Or they just put it on Instagram or something.
So we haven't talked yet about the piece that you're going to read.
Yeah.
But just for context of where we are now in sort of the life of Curtis Sittenfeld,
we're kind of
up through high school getting ready for college. When is this piece from?
This is perfect. This is high school. So I think it's 10th grade.
So is this, so you went to Groton. This is this after the sleepover that you didn't go to or something? Now everyone in the world knows about this. So in early high school, 9th and 10th grade, were you in a private school in Cincinnati, a public school?
Only to middle school. So I went
to school
in Cincinnati through middle school.
Got it. Okay.
And then I started boarding school in 9th grade.
Got it. Okay.
And went for 4 years.
Okay.
And
so this is from those years.
Well, and should I just read it and then?
Yeah.
Sure.
So this was an assignment in my 10th grade English class. And I don't remember what the assignment is, but there's a few reasons that I chose this. Okay, so it's called Birch Tree.
Cool.
In the autumn, the girls run by laughing and talking while their shiny ponytails bounce rhythmically atop their heads. They wear maroon shorts and gray shirts, the colors of the school. Sometimes they giggle too loudly and a booming voice from the end of the line yells at them to hurry up. I watch them carefully, but I don't understand girls. The boys I know well, as they have been here even longer than I have. When they walk in pairs, their faces are serious and they speak of important things. Sometimes a group comes down and they smoke and laugh raucously and absentmindedly peel the bark from my trunk. Many years ago, when females were still not allowed to attend the school and could only be invited for weekends, the boys brought their girlfriends for walks in the woods. This was what I loved to watch the most, for I was still young myself. Now I am old. The fall air is cold and the forest around me is quiet. I become weary easily. Once I was strong and proud. I loved my smooth white skin and my branches, which kept reaching higher every day until finally I reigned over all the other trees. In the summers, my leaves were bright green, and when the leaves fell, they turned rich shades of orange and red. Once, several years ago, an art teacher came with her class, and they sat on the trail a few feet away. On big pieces of white rectangular paper, they sketched me. I was happy that day, standing in the warm light of the late afternoon sun while they used fancy words to describe my trunk. But I was glad when they left, too, because I like the peace of the woods. At night, the stars are bright in the black sky. I look at them, but not the way I once did. When I was young, I longed to get out of the forest and to go to other far-off places. I wanted to jump carelessly on branches like the squirrels, or I wanted to travel in a pack the way the birds did, flying out of sight when the cold weather came. They are beginning to go now, but I am content to stay here. The woods are the only home I've known, and I am familiar with their various rhythms. Each evening, I observe the time from dusk to dark, and later the time from darkness to dawn. When it rains, the woods are somehow insulated, and I feel secure. Only the girls are still an enigma to me, the oblivious laughing girls in shiny black tights and cleated shoes.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Well,
that's amazing.
It's frustrating because it's perfect.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Also,
I couldn't find anything in there.
I don't know about...
Single thing.
I can find
about,
a lot.
You're going to have to find it for us.
I don't know about Lauren and Steven, but I was... It was right there in the title, but I was the shift to the perspective of the tree.
I'm so
good. And the line at the beginning of I don't understand girls and then coming back to it at the end.
Well, this is something I didn't understand girls either. And so I'd write stories like the stories were trying to figure out the girls, mm-hmm, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think at one point I had a book that was published and meant for boys, and it was called How to Talk to Girls.
Oh, that's amazing.
But the first, like, three or four sentences of that, especially with the maroon and the gray, mm-hmm, like,
it's beautiful.
I feel it, and I feel you, like, you're like, I'm going to figure this out.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's not amazing. It's still amazing. Considering how much writing you'd been done, probably had been doing before this, I mean, you can see how much writing you had done to build up to this point where there's just so much poise and assurance and sort of like...
It's already your voice, too.
It's just like so... assured and
again,
you know,
that's
it's amazing.
Well, okay, should I tell you guys? Because none of that is the
I mean, if
reason,
you want to reveal all the
please,
secret
please.
Flaws.
The reason I think it's funny is it's clearly set at my boarding school.
Right.
Even like the school color. So I think it's so funny that like, again, like my preoccupation, like it's almost like I just shifted the viewpoint and wrote my first novel. So it's like it's from the inside of and I think... I mean, it feels a little bit like influenced, perhaps overly influenced by The Giving Tree. But I think the assignment was probably like right from the perspective of, like an inanimate object. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember that. And the reason I this piece sort of looms large in my memory, I hadn't looked at it for many years, but for a really long time, it was like the last thing I had written that my mother unambivalently liked. And so it was like, I was probably like four novels in and she'd be like, remember Birch Tree?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, there was just,
that's when you were at your best, honey.
Yeah. Like I peaked early. Like she just, there was nothing kind of like awkwardly sexual. And there was nothing a little weird about our family. Right.
Maybe it's time to do like the sequel.
Oh my God, that would actually be super.
Send it to your
generous.
Mom.
Like maybe like for her 80th birthday.
I mean,
or I could be.
The tree's still there.
I could be I could write something. Actually, this is what I really should do.
I should
do like from the perspective of like a daffodil in her yard.
Oh, yeah.
And it should be just totally. I mean, she's a lovely person. It should be totally like rated G, like some like optimistic observations about life and plants.
Yeah, Mother's Day's coming up, you know.
I was going to say
it, like special edition printed.
Yeah.
That's
if nothing else, this podcast has prepared all of us and our listeners for the ideal Mother's Day gifts. I do so, find something that's
and we
interesting.
Found out all moms are the same.
Yeah. It's true. Something that's interesting whenever we do these episodes, I'm really struck by, and I understand as the writer, maybe you see different things, but just as Stephen was saying, the poise and just the talent and the understanding at that age of just how language works, mm-hmm. in particular, the details, the specificity, which again, when you talk about like sort of writing towards your obsessions, sort of having certain things, I've always been moved by your work because even if it's writers and characters that I don't immediately connect with or have completely other world experiences from, it is those details and those elements that pull me into a scene. This is our audience can't see right now, but you could hear it when you read it. It's a short, it is a short piece. And yet I can see the woods, the tree, the people, the ponytails bouncing in the light. It's like a Robert Frost poem, you know, it's so I just, the attention to that at an early age, it is to me quite impressive and something that I still look at in your current work and see like, oh man, the specificity here is what brings that scene to life. It's not about the plot. It's about what these characters are doing and how they're seeing the world around them.
Yeah. And just like the way you inhabit the tree so thoroughly and deeply, sort of with through all of its possibilities, seems really remarkable to me. Like I can imagine what I would have written, been like, you know.
But I mean, also too, like, there's something held back. Like, this is what I don't get. So a big part of becoming a writer is reading and then imitating, right?
We talked about this.
Lauren. We talked about this. And one thing that's amazing to me is I cannot figure out how you're doing what you're doing. And it's already happening in this story. Like, everything is being said up front, and yet there's so much hidden. And like, I will like go into the sentences you write and be like, how? Like, how is this happening? Like, how is this character both completely transparent and then also like, so like there's secrets that we're never going to know. And maybe the character doesn't even know. You know what I mean? And yeah, it's, I need some answers, basically.
that's very interesting. Because I take what you're saying as like a very high compliment. And I someone last night at my event at Prairie Lights said to me, kind of like she was saying, like, your fiction has this unputdownable quality, and kind of like, how do you do that? And which, again, that's obviously very subjective. Like, there are plenty of people who are like, your fiction does not have an unputdownable quality, Curtis. Right. Like, you know, like I you know, set it down on page 2 or whatever. But it's weird because sometimes I feel like what I'm trying to do, I mean, I am trying to construct a plot, and I'm trying to like essentially manipulate the reader in a way they'll be happy to have been manipulated or like they'll feel satisfied or something. But I also feel like I'm trying to be as straightforward as possible. Mm. And so sometimes, I mean, this is such a like kind of lacking in perspective thing to say, but like sometimes I almost feel like, oh, I don't have a voice. I'm just like writing like very straightforwardly.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, it's like thinking you don't have an accent and thinking mm-hmm, that other mm-hmm. people do have an accent.
Right. And you may not know how you're doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be the ultimate secret.
Yeah.
Why it's so inscrutable to, you know, other readers who are writers. Like, I want, you know, when I read, I'm also trying to learn how to do
it. Oh, of course, same.
The
yeah.
tricks.
Yeah.
The only other writer that also, like, baffles me is Sabrina Orem Mark. Her poetry and her writing, like, I'm like, how is she doing this?
So, by the way, I think she was my year. Yeah. Oh, so there was something in the water. And I think they even kind of lived on the same street.
No way.
There was something on East Washington in 1999.
Oh, wow. All right. That's the place to be.
Well, it's also just fascinating. You mentioned a second ago, Curtis, that like you write in a way that you feel is straightforward. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I find your work unputdownable. Because when I'm being sort of ejected into this world and I'm being just sort of skyrocketed into this place that I shouldn't know, mm-hmm. right? I also feel that because you give me a lot of that information, a little bit of the context, a lot about the character up front, I don't know where I'm going, but I'm like, suddenly I know where my feet are. It feels often like we were talking yesterday about ghosts and spirits. I feel sort of like I'm a ghost in this world that you're playing out around me, and I'm just able to see it all. And that comes back to specificity, but also in your ability as a writer to trust me enough to give me some of it and know that I'll keep going with it. And that is also like, those are the things that make my favorite television shows and favorite movies, where it's not all, we're going to give you all the background and exposition up front and lay it out. And it's what happens even in this piece. It starts with the things that you think you can connect to, and then it turns on a dime. And then at the end, it comes back in a certain way. Yeah. And I just am, I remain inspired by it. And I have, and I have a question to follow all that up with. So you go from writing this amazing piece that's published at such a young age.
This piece was not published.
Oh, it was.
This is my parents.
No, like, I was going to say that looks very
Published. Published.
This, interestingly, okay. So Prep came out in January 2005 when I was 29. And I feel like I'll describe it now as it was like the movie version of being a first novelist, which I think everyone kind of anticipates without even knowing they're anticipating it. And then it doesn't happen. And then they're like, oh. And so I was like extraordinarily lucky. And then in August 2005, you know, so 8 months later, 7 months later, I turned 30. And my parents, this is so like labor intensive. They basically kind of made this almost like self-published book of like what they considered to be my greatest hits of my writing.
Oh, that's incredible.
Which is so, so lovely. And so many of them, probably 75% of them, I wished wouldn't have ever seen the light of day. So it was this incredibly lovely, generous, uncomfortable present. And I think that because of how they had it printed, which was probably, you know, even sort of more complicated or obscure in 2005 than it would be now, I think they had to make like 50 copies. Like, I think that the number of people who would be interested in this would have been like a maximum of like 7.
We all have it, just in case.
Yeah, I could sell it on eBay. So it's like even like occasionally, actually, as recently as Christmas, you know, my siblings and I now all have kids, and they'll pull it down from the shelf in my mom's house, and someone will start reading it out, and I'll just be like, my God. Yeah. Like, I would not have
Well, at least this, but this was preserved, though.
I know, but it's also like, this is very carefully selected. Like, did you notice? I could have easily brought the whole self-published book, Xeroxed these two pages.
Well, that one's your mom's favorite. Yes.
Okay, so it wasn't published. So thanks for clarifying that.
It was not published.
But so you come from this, and then you go off to, you're in boarding school, and then you go to college.
Yeah.
And where do you go to college?
Well, two places. So I went to Vassar for 2 years, and then I transferred and went to Stanford. And I will say, I was super unhappy about Vassar. Is like a wonderful school. I was very lucky to go. I was super unhappy there. And I also, I think that it's almost like, again, like a movie version of where like a bookish girl should go to college. And I submitted stuff to the literary magazine and like couldn't get anything accepted. Whoa. And I ended up joining the staff of the weekly newspaper as a copy editor. And that was sort of where I found my people. Okay. But I really felt like I felt like kind of a creative writing reject at Vassar.
Ouch.
And then at Stanford, actually, I joined the newspaper. Those were like all my closest friends. Mm-hmm. And I think I sort of submitted to but stayed away from the literary magazine, because I was almost like, oh, those are those – because of Vassar, like those are those snotty, pretentious people who wouldn't like me anyway.
Yeah.
And the newspaper people are my people.
So were you – but you continued writing all through, through college.
Yeah.
And were you – what were you working on then? Had you started Prep? Yeah. When did you sort of –
I started Prep when I was at Iowa.
Okay.
So this is when I said
on East Washington Street.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. In January 2000.
Okay.
I had written a short story, which again has all the like. It's almost like I'm just like playing with the same ingredients over and over, and I had a story published in Ms. Magazine the summer after I graduated from high school, written in the second person.
Wow.
And based on that, an editor at Little Brown reached out and said, would you be interested in writing a novel? And so what I did was I like took, you know, I had written like endless short stories about, like, you know, a self-conscious girl, whatever. And I kind of, like, mashed them up into a novel. And I also, because I was unhappy at Vassar, I was like, obviously, having a novel come out from Little Brown when I'm 19 will, like, rescue me from my happiness, you know, permanently. And then, you know, and I actually had lunch with the editor in Boston one day. And then she read what I had sent her and she was like, this doesn't, like, this is not a novel. And I also, I'm 99% sure she's the editor who went on to, like, discover and edit and publish the Twilight series.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, so she, I mean, she had an eye.
Yeah, she was looking. You just need to put some vampires.
But also, she's. I mean, so I was 29, as I said, when Prep came out. I feel like, thank God, that mashed up. Which, and then to be perfectly honest, because we don't always learn from our mistakes, I kind of. So I have a second novel that many people don't know exists. You obviously did, like, The Man of My Dreams, which I mean, I feel like I bash it into an almost, like, disrespectful, like sometimes if somebody's like, but I loved it, and I'll be like, so you're the one, or whatever, or like, or but even, it's this hilarious thing where, like, at one point when my book American Wife came out, someone at my publishing house was writing up copy, and they were like, Curtis Sittenfeld's long-awaited second novel, and I was like, it's not my second novel, it's my third novel, but I kind of did the same thing with The Man of My Dreams, where I kind of mashed up short story. And it's like, again, I did learn, you like, maybe some people can. I cannot mash up short stories and make them into a novel. Like, it will not have, like, a satisfying structural arc.
So how did you handle that when that editor told you that? Was it hard to hear? Like, was
of course. Yeah. I mean, it was like a weird, because it really had, again, like, it had probably felt like a movie version of being a person, or like.
Clearly you recovered. I can see how that'd be really tough to hear, though.
I mean, again, but the funny thing, like, I feel like that it was more like, I think I probably had a belief then, like almost like, I'm unhappy and some external thing could fall from the sky and make me happy, which of course is, I mean, that's very much like a 18 or 19 year old thing to think. But I do think, you know, like the whole, like, is it, I don't know if it's like Garth Brooks or like the sort of like broken, like, it's almost like, thank God for unanswered prayers or whatever. Like, yeah.
It's very human. It's very human to think that you will achieve something and then you'll be forever happy.
Yeah. And it's very writerly-ish too. Yeah.
Well, so after you go from Vassar to Stanford and then you end up in Iowa, what was your time here like?
So I loved being at Iowa, and in some ways, like, I had ultimately really liked Stanford, but I think because I went to two schools for 2 years, you know, I don't know if I didn't have as sort of like deep or settled a college experience as some people do. And when I came here, I remember actually started, my first workshop was on my 24th birthday. And I was in a class. There was one other woman in a workshop of 8 people. The professor was Chris Offit. That woman's name is Susanna Daniel. I would say she's like my best friend to this day. She lives in Madison. And I remember going to George's after the first workshop and talking about, do you know the writer Marley Swick, who writes like sort of short stories? And I think she was maybe taught at the University of Nebraska, and having a conversation with a few other people about her short stories. And I had never met another human who had like heard of her, let alone could have a conversation, have opinions about her fiction. So, or like, you know, like at this point, this is, you know, not true for me now, but like going to, you know, readings at Prairie Lights 4 nights a week was exhilarating to me. Like I think I felt like I should fall in love and like find my husband at Iowa. There wasn't anyone who was in agreement
with that plan.
But
it's rough. You know, it's rough out there.
Yeah. But it's like there was the second best thing, which there was like lots of people to have big crushes on.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, I mean, crushes are better than marriage.
They really are.
Let's be honest.
Oh, I protect my crushes way more than my marriage.
I've been really struck since I read it. I believe it was in the New Yorker first, but the first collection, or the first story in your new collection, which takes place at the program and is about second year funding, you know, the sort of reference to the farmhouse and all of these other things. I found myself transported back to my own time here at the workshop and just...
Curtis, they tore down the farmhouse and built an elementary school on that land.
Oh my God. Oh my
right
God.
Right where that farmhouse was. God,
that's so
and
weird.
My kid went to it for a year.
That's it's so weird because I feel like it must be, it's like haunted. Yeah.
It's very haunted.
Don't go there.
I felt yeah. so weird. I was like, no, no, no.
That's wild.
You don't know what we did in that
yeah.
farm.
Yeah. Yeah. That should be the name of like a short story
right.
or a poem. Yeah.
Right.
What we did in the corn. Yeah.
No, you don't
you
know.
Don't know.
You don't know what we did
in
this
that corn.
Oh, man.
That's amazing. Because it also has such a, like, that's such an understandable thing to say in Iowa. But then it also, like, people, like, in other places, people might be like, in the corn? How is that even possible? So it's, like, intriguing.
I remember, like, I mean, we were young and we were partying and we went out, me and three guys I didn't know, and we decided to make a room in the corn. So we ruined this farmer's. We pushed down the corn to make like a 7-foot by 7-foot square. And then we were like, we made a room. Yay. And like, then
the guy went the farmer went into debt.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Sell the farm.
I have to say that like sets off my short story. I will not take it, but
please
I've,
take it.
That's such
that would
a,
be honored.
That's a, such a short story that it's not like a writer's workshop short story, but it's like a different, it's like an undergraduate, maybe in Iowa short story.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like so weird, but real.
And your mom would love it because
right.
you call it nothing
corn,
happened because I was like terrible
room.
At flirting and figuring out
right.
boys too. And right. so your mom would be really happy.
How
with
to
that.
Talk to boys.
How to yeah. talk to boys in a corn room.
It's a great story.
Good. So I'm curious, Curtis, like what, when you read this piece, what do you see that has carried forward sort of all the way or far into the future sort of through the rest of your work? Like what jumps out at you? Do you look back and think to yourself, oh, I was thinking about this even then? Or
I mean, I do think it's funny that it's like, it's sort of like prep from a different perspective, you know, like sort of like, but I also like, so I'm trying to think what year this was. In 2017, my parents moved from out of the house that my siblings and I had grown up in. And my sisters and I sort of went back and cleaned out our rooms, which had sort of been, you know, they sort of had some of our junk still in them. And I unearthed, so again, 2017, by that point, I'm trying to think how many, like let's say I'd had 6 books published maybe. And I uncover all these like poets and writers, almost when it looked like a, just Xeroxed pieces of paper, more like it wasn't even shiny or whatever. And I have to say, there was something a little bit humbling where I was like, I wanted the career that I have so badly. Mm-hmm. And I worked very deliberately and strategically for it. And now that I'm like 49 and, you know, have been with Random House for more than 20 years, like I do sometimes feel very tempted to like make fun of myself, make fun of my writing, like certain little thing, like make fun of entire books. But it's like, again, like I wanted this so much. And I mean, I feel very, very conscious literally every day of my life how lucky I am. And it's very, I mean, like I think that there's ways, there's like interests I have or like things I've done that have maybe made it more likely that I've had some of the commercial success that I've had, but it's definitely not pure talent and it's not pure hard work. And it's like there are many people that I went to Iowa with who are much more like beautiful writers at the level of a sentence. There's people, probably most people I know who are my classmates at Iowa, whether they write fiction or not, they probably literally work harder than I do in terms of like hours in the day or something. So it's like, I don't, maybe I'm saying like unrelated, but I feel very conscious of my and just like there is something about, and being in Iowa City, it's kind of one of these moments where you're kind of like this is who I was, yeah. and this is what I wanted, and then I got it, but then mm-hmm. like also like life is really strange, and because I even remember, I mean, should I feel like this actually, like you're like, when are the words gonna stop coming out?
No, please go.
Okay, so you know that bridge on Summit, like you kind of were walking, and I think I lived on East Washington, obviously, and would walk on Summit Avenue, and I think I was almost like. Like my dream would be to be a professor in the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Mm-hmm. I think I wanted to be Ethan Koenig and Barb Koenig, yeah. both of them. Life doesn't work that way. You only get to be one of them.
Right.
At best, you get to be one of them. Maybe you probably most of us get to be like neither of them. But I was like, I would love to be a professor in the Iowa Writers' Workshop and like live in a big house on Summit, be married and have kids and have a writing career. And then I remember in 2005 when Prep came out and it was like a bestseller and like I had a boyfriend and almost like standing on that bridge and being like, oh my God, like I have a best-selling first novel, I have a boyfriend, like, and sort of feeling like I feel so grateful and like I'm still myself or like there's still gnawing hunger inside me. And now it's like, here I am and all these years have passed and it's like, there's still the gnawing hunger inside.
You're talking about The Bridge by Deluxe, right?
Yes, exactly.
You've officially won Best Guest because you have led us directly to one of our final questions, which is, what would you say to that 15-year-old? If you were to go back in time and talk to that 15-year-old and say, look what we did, what would she think?
I mean, again, it just like, and I felt this doing this event at Prairie Lights because also now I'm so far on the other side of things. Like I'm 49. And like, I would not assume that anyone who's a current student in the workshop would come to my book event. You know, like
Tons of them there.
But I wouldn't be surprised. Just given what our culture thinks of like essentially of middle-aged women, I would not assume that anyone who's like in their 20s and very ambitious would come. You know, so it was like oh my God. I mean, again, I do feel very lucky. But I will say that I think that there is some emotional rawness in my writing that people can relate to. And I think the fact that hasn't gone away for me has probably made me a better writer and made it like more painful to be a person. Or
oh,
something.
Yeah.
Go
those
figure.
Two go hand in hand.
Yeah. I mean, do you think those go away? Do you think it goes away for other writers? Or like is there anyone you've interviewed where you're like, oh, the emotional rawness has gone away for them?
I mean, I don't think so. And I think you said something before that any student, any writer, anybody who's listening to this, what I love for them to hear, to take away from this is you're still hungry for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the writers that we've been lucky to interview on this podcast, including yourself, are writers that are still committed to making art, not for the sake of anything else than trying to push their own art forward. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that you can say to yourself, like, and I'm still hungry. I still have that yearning to write the next thing and do the next thing. To me, that suggests that you still want it.
Yeah. And all that complexity that you experience in everyday life and the things that keep getting stranger and more complex just sort of feed into your work, and clearly that's something that's, you know, you're very open to. So
it's also the Buddhist cycle of suffering. So we never get what we want because what we want always changes.
Mm.
Sorry, guys.
No, it's okay.
But your 15-year-old, like, would she be proud of you? Would she be pumped?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think she would be sort of disbelieving.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. 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 Like again, I think that I could have gotten a lot less than I have gotten and been like thrilled. I mean, again, you have to remember, like, it's like I'm a second child. I'm from the Midwest. Like, my expectations were not that high.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this new book.
Oh, yeah. Tell us a little bit about this new book.
So I wrote a story collection called Show, Don't Tell. And it's 12 stories, one of which is set in a setting much like the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1999. One is a sequel short story to my first novel, Prep. And then the very succinct way I sometimes describe this when I'm making fun of my stories, I say they're about like grouchy, liberal, Midwestern women.
Yeah.
that brings me up to a question I've been thinking a lot about, which is you have a novel that we've talked a lot about in the office that sort of is about George W. Bush and his wife, but they are not named, and it is changed in terms of the narrative and the characters. And then you have a novel that's really incredible called Rodham, which has very real people and then yet sort of changes the course of their narrative. Mm. And in your story collection, I was really taken by the decisions you make. There's a story that sort of has a Jeff Bezos-like character, but it's not named Jeff Bezos. And then later, there's some characters that are speaking very specifically about current politicians and other things. So I'm curious, as a writer, when and how do you make the choice to sort of bring in the quote-unquote real world of this sort of culture that society we're all living in? And when do you make the decision to completely change it and fictionalize it fully?
And how do you make the decision?
I think that that's a great question that I sometimes struggle with. And like it's almost impossible to answer consistently, because it's almost like I think I do it by instinct. And even like in my novel, Romantic Comedy, you know, it's like a person at a woman who's a writer for a show like SNL, and she kind of has chemistry with this fictional, you know, pop singer named Noah. But then they have conversations about real musicians like the Indigo Girls.
Right.
And so there's this weird and I'm very conscious of like, okay, well, Noah's made up, but the Indigo Girls are real. But I think of it almost like, and I even wondered this with Rodham, where like Hillary's name is Hillary, mm-hmm. Bill's name is Bill. But then I was like, are Hillary's brothers, do they have their real names? Or is that like a violation of them? Or they? And so I think it's all on a case-by-case basis.
So even down in that novel in particular, even down into like characters within a family that is partly real, you would allow yourself to fictionalize.
I think I'd made the decision
fascinating.
To use the brothers' real names, but to try to use the brothers as very lightly as possible, because it did start to feel weird. And even, again, like with these writing fiction that's sort of inspired from real life figures, but is also very much fiction, like I feel like I wouldn't bring in people's children. So, you know, like in the Laura Bush book, she has one daughter. She doesn't have twins. And which, again, somebody might be like, that book is intrusive or that book is a violation. And like, oh, that's where you draw the line. And I'd kind of be like, yeah, that actually is where I draw the line. Yeah. You know, like I have rules for myself, but, you know, nobody necessarily knows what they are outside of my head.
Yeah. Well, as an audience member and a reader, it works really well for me. I never know what to expect from those. And the new collection is just wonderful. Like I said, some of those stories have been published in other publications. To see them in one space and then to read the new ones has been really wonderful. So congrats on the new book.
Thank you. Oh, my goodness.
And thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being here.
It was
just wonderful.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.